Rainbird continued to stare at Hockstetter. "Don't call me a fool again," he said in a perfectly neutral voice. Hockstetter flinched, but only a little. "Please, gentlemen," Cap said wearily. "Please." There was a tape recorder on his desk. They had just finished listening to the conversation Rainbird had had with Charlie that morning. "Apparently Dr. Hockstetter has missed the point that he and his team are finally going to get something," Rainbird said, "which will improve their store of practical knowledge by 100%, if my mathematics are correct." "As the result of a totally unforeseen accident," Hockstetter said sullenly. "An accident you people were too short-sighted to manufacture for yourselves," Rainbird countered. "Too busy playing with your rats, maybe." "Gentlemen, that's enough," Cap said. "We're not here to indulge in a lot of recriminations. That is not the purpose of this meeting." He looked at Hockstetter. "You're going to get to play ball," he said. "I must say you show remarkably little gratitude." Hockstetter muttered. Cap looked at Rainbird. "All the same, I also think you took your role of amicus curiae a little bit too far in the end." "Do you think so? Then you still don't understand." He looked from Cap to Hockstetter, and then back to Cap again. "I think both of you have shown an almost paralyzing lack of understanding. You've got two child psychiatrists at your disposal, and if they are an accurate representation of the caliber of that field, there are a lot of disturbed kids out there who have got big-time trouble." "Easy to say," Hockstetter said. "You just don't understand how smart she is," Rainbird cut him off. "You don't understand how adept she is at seeing the causes and effects of things. Working with her is like picking your way through a minefield. I pointed out the carrot and stick idea to her because she would have thought of it herself. By thinking of it for her, I've shored up the trust she has in me. In effect, turned a disadvantage into an advantage." Hockstetter opened his mouth. Cap held up one hand and then turned to Rainbird. He spoke in a soft, placatory tone that he used with no one else. But then, no one else was John Rainbird. "That doesn't alter the fact that you seem to have limited how far Hockstetter and his people can go. Sooner or later, she's going to understand that her ultimate request, to see her father, is not going to be granted. We're all in agreement that to allow that might close off her usefulness to us forever." "Right on," Hockstetter said. "And if she's as sharp as you say," Cap said, "she's apt to make the ungrantable request sooner rather than later." "She'll make it," Rainbird agreed. "And that will end it. For one thing, she'd realize as soon as she saw him that I was lying all along about his condition. That would lead her to the conclusion that I had been shilling for you guys all along. So it becomes entirely a question of how long you can keep her going." Rainbird leaned forward. "A couple of points. First, you've both got to get used to the idea that she's simply not going to light fires for you ad infinitum. She's a human being. A little girl who wants to see her father. She's not a lab rat." "We've already..." Hockstetter began impatiently. "No. No, you haven't. It goes back to the very basis of the reward system in experimentation. The carrot and the stick. By lighting fires, Charlie thinks she's holding out the carrot to you, and that she will eventually lead you, and herself, to her father. But we know differently. In truth, her father is the carrot, and we are leading her. Now, a mule will plow the whole South 40 trying to get that carrot dangling in front of his eyes, because a mule is stupid. But this little girl isn't." He looked at Cap and Hockstetter. "I keep saying that. It is like pounding a nail into oak. Oak of the first cutting. Hard going, don't you know? You both seem to keep forgetting. Sooner or later, she's going to wise up and tell you to stick it. Because she isn't a mule. Or a white lab rat." And you want her to quit, Cap thought with slow loathing. You want her to quit so you can kill her. So you start with that one basic fact, Rainbird continued. That's go. Then you start thinking of ways to prolong her cooperation as long as possible. Then, when it's over, you write your report. If you get enough data, you get rewarded with a big cash appropriation. You get to eat the carrot. Then you can start injecting a bunch of poor, ignorant slobs with your witch's brew all over again. You're being insulting, Hochstetter said in a shaking voice. It beats the terminal stupids, Rainbird answered. How do you propose to prolong her cooperation? You'll get some mileage out of her just by granting small privileges, Rainbird said. A walk on the lawn. Or, every little girl loves horses. I'll bet you could get half a dozen fires out of her just by having a groom lead her around the bridle paths on one of those stable nags. That ought to be enough to keep a dozen paper pushers like Hochstetter dancing on the head of a pin for 5 years. Hochstetter pushed back from the table. I don't have to sit here and listen to this. Sit down and shut up, Cap said. Hot blood slammed into Hochstetter's face and he looked ready to fight. It left as suddenly as it had come, and he looked ready to cry. Then he sat down again. You let her go into town and shop, Rainbird said. Maybe you arrange for her to go to Seven Flags over Georgia and ride the roller coaster. Maybe even with her good friend, John the Orderly. You seriously think just those things? Cap began. No, I don't. Not for long. Sooner or later, it will get back to her father. But she's only human. She wants things for herself as well. She'll go quite a ways down the road you want her to go down, just by rationalizing it to herself. Telling herself she's showing you the flash before grabbing the cash. But eventually, it's going to get back to dear old Dad's. Yes. She's no sellout, that one. She's tough. And that's the end of the trolley car ride, Cap said thoughtfully. Everybody out. The project ends. This phase of it, anyway. In many ways, the prospect of an end in sight relieved him tremendously. Not right there, no, Rainbird said, smiling his mirthless smile. We have one more card up our sleeve. One more very large carrot, when the smaller ones play out. Not her father, not the grand prize, but something that will keep her going yet a while longer. And what would that be? Hochstetter asked. You figure it out, Rainbird said, still smiling, and said no more. Cap might, in spite of how far he had come unraveled over the last half year or so. He had more smarts on half power than most of his employees, and all the pretenders to his throne, had on full power. As for Hochstetter, he would never see it. Hochstetter had risen several floors past his level of incompetency, a feat more possible in the federal bureaucracy than elsewhere. Hochstetter would have trouble following his nose to a shit and cream cheese sandwich. Not that it mattered if any of them figured out what the final carrot, the game carrot, one might say, in this little contest was. The results would still be the same. It was going to put him comfortably in the driver's seat, one way or the other. He might have asked them, "Who do you think her father is, now that her father isn't there?" Let them figure it out for themselves, if they could. John Rainbird went on smiling. 4. Andy McGee sat in front of his television set. The little amber home box office pilot light glowed in the square gadget on top of the TV. On the screen, Richard Dreyfuss was trying to build the Devil's Butte in his living room. Andy watched with a calm and vapid expression of pleasure. Inside, he was boiling with nervousness. Today was the day. For Andy, the 3 weeks since the blackout had been a period of almost unbearable tension and strain, interwoven with bright threads of guilty exhilaration. He could understand simultaneously how the Russian KGB could inspire such terror, and how George Orwell's Winston Smith must have enjoyed his brief period of crazy, furtive rebellion. He had a secret again. It gnawed and worked in him, as all grave secrets do within the minds of their keepers. but it also made him feel whole and potent again. He was putting one over on them. God knew how long he would be able to continue, or if it would come to anything, but right now he was doing it. It was almost 10 in the morning, and Pinchot, that eternally grinning man, was coming at 10. They would be going for a walk in the garden to discuss his progress. Andy intended to push him, or at least try. He might have made the effort before this, except for the TV monitors and the endless bugging devices, and the wait had given him time to think out his line of attack and probe it again and again for weak spots. He had, in fact, rewritten parts of the scenario in his mind many times. At night, lying in bed in the dark, he had thought over and over again, "Big Brother is watching. Just keep telling yourself that. Keep it foremost in your mind. They've got you locked up right in the forebrain of Big Brother. And if you really expect to help Charlie, you've got to keep on fooling them." He was sleeping less than he ever had in his life, mostly because he was terrified of talking in his sleep. Some nights he lay wakeful for hours, afraid even to toss and turn in case they should wonder why a drugged man should be so restless. And when he did sleep, it was thin, shot with strange dreams. Often the Long John Silver figure, the one-eyed pirate with the peg leg, recurred in these, and easily broken. Slipping the pills was the easiest part, because they believed he wanted them. The pills came 4 times a day now, and there had been no more tests since the blackout. He believed they had given up, and that was what Pinchot wanted to tell him today on his walk. Sometimes he would cough the pills out of his mouth into his cupped hand and put them in food scraps he would later scrape down the garbage disposal. More went down the toilet. Still others he had pretended to take with ginger ale. He spat the pills into the half-empty cans to dissolve and then let them stand as if forgotten. Later he would turn them down the sink. God knew he was no professional at this, and presumably the people who were monitoring him were. But he didn't think they were monitoring him very closely anymore. If they were, he would be caught. That was all. Dreyfus and the woman whose son had been taken for a ride by the saucer people were scaling the side of Devil's Butte when the buzzer that marked the breaking of the door circuit went off briefly. Andy didn't let himself jump. "This is it," he told himself again. Herman Pinchot came into the living room. He was shorter than Andy, but very slender. There was something about him that had always struck Andy as slightly effeminate, although it was nothing you could put your finger on. Today he was looking extremely neat and complete in a thin gray turtleneck sweater and a summer weight jacket, and of course he was grinning. "Good morning, Andy," he said. "Oh," Andy said, and then paused, as if to think. "Hello, Dr. Pinchot. Do you mind if I turn this off? We ought to go for our walk, you know." "Oh." Andy's brow furrowed, then cleared. "Sure. I've seen it 3 or 4 times already. But I like the ending. It's pretty. The UFOs take him away, you know. To the stars." "Really?" Pinchot said, and turned off the TV. "Shall we go?" "Where?" Andy asked. "Our walk," Herman Pinchot said patiently. "Remember?" "Oh," Andy said. "Sure." He got up. 5. The hall outside Andy's room was wide and tile-floored. The lighting was muted and indirect. Somewhere not far away was a communications or computer center. People strolled in with key-punch cards, out with swatches of printouts, and there was the hum of light machinery. A young man in an off-the-rack sport coat, the essence of government agent, lounged outside the door of Andy's apartment. There was a bulge under his arm. The agent was a part of the standard operating procedure, but as he and Pinchot strolled, he would fall behind them, watching, but out of earshot. Andy thought he would be no problem. The agent fell in behind them now as he and Pinchot strolled to the elevator. Andy's heartbeat was now so heavy it felt as if it were shaking his entire ribcage. But without seeming to, he was watching everything closely. There were perhaps a dozen unmarked doors, Some of them he had seen standing open on other walks up this corridor. A small, specialized library of some kind. A photocopying room in another. But about many of them, he simply had no idea. Charlie might be behind any one of them right now. Or in some other part of the installation entirely. They got into the elevator, which was big enough to accommodate a hospital gurney. Pinchett produced his keys, twisted one of them in the keyway, and pushed one of the unmarked buttons. The doors closed, and the elevator rose smoothly. The shop agent lounged at the back of the car. Andy stood with his hands in the pockets of his Lee Riders, a slight, vapid smile on his face. The elevator door opened on what had once been a ballroom. The floor was polished oak, pegged together. Across the wide expanse of the room, a spiral staircase made a graceful double twist on its way to the upper levels. To the left, French doors gave onto a sunny terrace and the rock garden beyond it. From the right, where heavy oak doors stood half open, came the clacking sound of a typing pool, putting out that day's two bales of paperwork. And from everywhere came the smell of fresh flowers. Pinchett led the way across the sunny ballroom, and as always, Andy commented on the pegged-together floor as if he had never noticed it before. They went through the French doors with their shop shadow behind them. It was very warm, very humid. Bees buzzed lazily through the air. Beyond the rock garden were hydrangea, forsythia, and rhododendron bushes. There was the sound of riding lawnmowers making their eternal rounds. Andy turned his face up to the sun with a gratitude that wasn't feigned. "How are you feeling, Andy?" Pinchett asked. "Good, good." "You know, you've been here almost half a year now," Pinchett said in an "isn't it amazing how the time flies when you're having a good time" tone of mild surprise. They turned right into one of the graveled paths. The smell of honeysuckle and sweet sassafras hung in the still air. On the other side of the duck pond, near the other house, two horses cantered lazily along. "That long," Andy said. "Yes, it is a long time," Pinchett said, grinning. "And we've decided that your power has diminished, Andy. In fact, you know, we've had no appreciable results at all." "Well, you keep me drugged all the time," Andy said reproachfully. "You can't expect me to do my best if I'm stoned." Pinchett cleared his throat, but did not point out that Andy had been totally clean for the first three series of tests, and all three had been fruitless. "I mean, I've done my best, Dr. Pinchett. I've tried." "Yes, yes, of course you have. And we think, that is, I think, that you deserve a rest. Now, the shop has a small compound on Maui, in the Hawaii chain, Andy, and I have a 6-month report to write very soon. How would you like it," Pinchett's grin broadened into a game show host's leer, and his voice took on the tones of a man about to offer a child an incredible treat, "how would you like it if I recommended that you be sent there for the immediate future?" And the immediate future might be 2 years, Andy thought. Maybe 5. They would want to keep an eye on him in case the mental domination ability recurred, and maybe as an ace in the hole in case some unforeseen difficulty with Charlie cropped up. But in the end, he had no doubt that there would be an accident, or an overdose, or a suicide. In Orwell's parlance, he would become an unperson. "Would I still get my medication?" Andy asked. "Oh, of course," Pinchett said. "Hawaii," Andy said dreamily. Then he looked around at Pinchett with what he hoped was an expression of rather stupid cunning. "Probably Dr. Hochstetter won't let me go. Dr. Hochstetter doesn't like me. I can tell." "Oh, he does," Pinchett assured him. "He does like you, Andy. And in any case, you're my baby, not Dr. Hochstetter's. I assure you he'll go along with what I advise." "But you haven't written your memorandum on the subject yet," Andy said. "No, I thought I'd talk to you first. But really, Hochstetter's approval is just a formality." "One more series of tests might be wise," Andy said, and pushed out lightly at Pinchett. "Just for safety's sake." Pinchett's eyes suddenly fluttered in a strange way. His grin faltered, became puzzled, and then faded altogether. Now Pinchett was the one who looked drugged, and the thought gave Andy a vicious kind of satisfaction. Bees droned in the flowers. The scent of new-cut grass, heavy and cloying, hung in the air. When you write your report, suggest one more series of tests, Andy repeated. Pinchot's eyes cleared. His grin came splendidly back. Of course, this Hawaii thing is just between us for the time being, he said. When I write my report, I will be suggesting one more series of tests. I think it might be wise, just for safety's sake, you know. But after that, I might go to Hawaii? Yes, Pinchot said. After that. And another series of tests might take 3 months or so? Yes, about 3 months. Pinchot beamed on Andy as if he were a prize pupil. They were nearing the pond now. Ducks sailed lazily across its mirror surface. The two men paused by it. Behind them, the young man in the sport coat was watching a middle-aged man and woman cantering along side by side on the far side of the pond. Their reflections were broken only by the long, smooth glide of one of the white ducks. Andy thought the couple looked eerily like an ad for mail-order insurance, the kind of ad that's always falling out of your Sunday paper and into your lap, or your coffee. There was a small pulse of pain in his head, not bad at all. But in his nervousness, he had come very close to pushing Pinchot much harder than he had to. And the young man might have noticed the results of that. He didn't seem to be watching them. But Andy wasn't fooled. Tell me a little about the roads and the countryside around here, he said quietly to Pinchot, and pushed out lightly again. He knew from various snatches of conversation that they were not terribly far from Washington, D.C., but nowhere as close as the CIA's base of operations in Langley. Beyond that, he knew nothing. Very pretty here, Pinchot said dreamily. Since they've filled the holes. Yes, it is nice, Andy said, and lapsed into silence. Sometimes a push triggered an almost hypnotic trace memory in the person being pushed, usually through some obscure association, and it was unwise to interrupt whatever was going on. It could set up an echo effect, and the echo could become a ricochet, and the ricochet could lead to, well, to almost anything. It had happened to one of his Walter Mitty businessmen, and it had scared the bejesus out of Andy. It had turned out okay, but if friend Pinchot suddenly got a case of the screaming horrors, it would be anything but okay. My wife loves that thing, Pinchot said in that same dreamy voice. What's that? Andy asked. That she loves. Her new garbage disposer. It's very... He trailed off. Very pretty, Andy suggested. The guy in the sport coat had drifted a little closer, and Andy felt a fine sweat break on his upper lip. Very pretty, Pinchot agreed and looked vaguely out at the pond. The shop agent came closer still, and Andy decided he might have to risk another push. A very small one. Pinchot was standing beside him like a TV set with a blown tube. The shadow picked up a small chunk of wood and tossed it in the water. It struck lightly, and ripples spread, shimmering. Pinchot's eyes fluttered. The country is very pretty around here, Pinchot said. Quite hilly, you know. Good riding country. My wife and I ride here once a week, if we can get away. I guess Dawn's the closest town going west, southwest, actually. Pretty small. Dawn's on Highway 301. Geether's the closest town going east. Is Geether on a highway? Nope, just on a little road. Where does Highway 301 go, besides Dawn? Why, all the way up to D.C. if you go north. Most of the way to Richmond if you go south. Andy wanted to ask about Charlie now, had planned to ask about Charlie, but Pinchot's reaction had scared him a little. His association of wife, holes, pretty, and very strange, garbage disposer, had been peculiar and somehow disquieting. It might be that Pinchot, although accessible, was nevertheless not a good subject. It might be that Pinchot was a disturbed personality of some sort, tightly corseted into an appearance of normality, while God knew what forces might be delicately counterbalanced underneath. Pushing people who were mentally unstable could lead to all sorts of unforeseen results. If it hadn't been for the shadow, he might have tried anyway. After all that had happened to him, he had damn few compunctions about messing with Herman Pinchot's head. But now he was afraid to. A psychiatrist with the push might be a great boon to mankind. But Andy McGee was no shrink. Maybe it was foolish to assume so much from a single trace memory reaction. He had got them before from a good many people, and very few of them had freaked out. But he didn't trust Pinchot. Pinchot smiled too much. A sudden cold and murderous voice spoke from deep inside him, from some well sunk far into his subconscious. Tell him to go home and commit suicide. Then push him. Push him hard. He thrust the thought away, horrified and a little sickened. Well, Pinchot said, looking around, grinning, shall we returnez-vous? Sure, Andy said. And so he had begun. But he was still in the dark about Charlie. 6. Interdepartmental memo. From Herman Pinchot to Patrick Hochstetter. Date, September 12th. Ray, Andy McGee. I've been over all of my notes and most of the tapes in the last 3 days and have spoken to McGee. There is no essential change in the situation since we last discussed it, 9-5. But for the time being, I'd like to put the Hawaii idea on hold if there is no big objection. As Captain Hollister himself says, it's only money. The fact is, Pat, I believe that a final series of tests might be wise, just for safety's sake. After that, we might go ahead and send him to the Maui compound. I believe that a final series might take 3 months or so. Please advise before I start the necessary paperwork. Herm. 7. Interdepartmental memo. From PH to Herm Pinchot. Date, September 13. Ray, Andy McGee. I don't get it. The last time we all got together, we agreed, you as much as any of us, that McGee was as dead as a used fuse. You can only hesitate so long at the bridge, you know. If you want to schedule another series of tests, an abbreviated series, then be my guest. We're starting with the girl next week, but thanks to a good deal of inept interference from a certain source, I think it likely that her cooperation may not last long. While it does, it might not be a bad idea to have her father around. As a fire extinguisher? Oh yes, it may be only money, but it is the taxpayer's money. And levity on that subject is rarely encouraged, Herm, especially by Captain Hollister. Keep it in mind. Plan on having him for 6 to 8 weeks at most, unless you get results. And if you do, I'll personally eat your hush puppies. Pat. 8. Son of a fucking bitch, Herm Pinchot said aloud as he finished reading this memorandum. He reread the third paragraph. Here was Hochstetter. Hochstetter, who owned a completely restored 1958 Thunderbird, spanking him about money. He crumpled up the memo and threw it at the wastebasket and leaned back in his swivel chair. 2 months at most, he didn't like that. 3 would have been more like it. He really felt that, unbidden and mysterious, a vision of the garbage disposal unit he had installed at home rose in his mind. He didn't like that either. The disposal unit had somehow got into his mind lately, and he didn't seem to be able to get it out. It came to the fore particularly when he tried to deal with the question of Andy McGee. The dark hole in the center of the sink was guarded by a rubber diaphragm. Vaginal, that. He leaned farther back in his chair, dreaming. When he came out of it with a start, he was disturbed to see that almost 20 minutes had gone by. He drew a memo form toward him and scratched out a note to that dirty bird Hochstetter, eating the obligatory helping of crow about his ill-advised, it's only money comment. He had to restrain himself from repeating his request for 3 months, and in his mind the image of the disposer's smooth dark hole rose again. If Hochstetter said 2, it was 2. But if he did get results with McGee, Hochstetter was going to find 2 size 9 hush puppies sitting on his desk blotter 15 minutes later, along with a knife, a fork, and a bottle of Adolph's meat tenderizer. He finished the note, scrawled Herm across the bottom, and sat back, massaging his temples. He had a headache. In high school and in college, Herm Pinchot had been a closet transvestite. He liked to dress up in women's clothes because he thought they made him look, well, very pretty. His junior year in college, as a member of Delta Tau Delta, he had been discovered by two of his fraternity brothers. The price of their silence had been a ritual humiliation, not much different from the pledge hazing that Pinchot himself had participated in with high good humor. At 2 o'clock in the morning, his discoverers had spread trash and garbage from one end of the fraternity kitchen to the other, and had forced Pinchot, dressed only in ladies' panties, stockings and garter belt, and a bra stuffed with toilet paper, to clean it all up, and then wash the floor, under constant threat of discovery. All it would have taken was another frat brother wandering down for an early morning snack. The incident had ended in mutual masturbation, which Pinchot supposed he should have been grateful for. It was probably the only thing that caused them to really keep their promise. But he had dropped out of the frat, terrified and disgusted with himself, most of all because he had found the entire incident somehow exciting. He had never cross-dressed since that time. He was not gay. He had a lovely wife and two fine children, and that proved he was not gay. He hadn't even thought of that humiliating, disgusting incident in years. And yet, the image of the garbage disposal, that smooth black hole faced with rubber, remained, and his headache was worse. The echo set off by Andy's push had begun. It was lazy and slow-moving now. The image of the disposal, coupled with the idea of being very pretty, was still an intermittent thing. But it would speed up, begin to ricochet, until it became unbearable. 9. "No," Charlie said, "it's wrong." And she turned around to march right out of the small room again. Her face was white and strained. There were dark, purplish dashes under her eyes. "Hey, whoa, wait a minute," Hochstetter said, putting out his hands. He laughed a little. "What's wrong, Charlie?" "Everything," she said. "Everything's wrong." Hochstetter looked at the room. In one corner, a Sony TV camera had been set up. Its cords led through the pressed cork wall to a VCR in the observation room next door. On the table in the middle of the room was a steel tray loaded with wood chips. To the left of this was an electroencephalograph, dripping wires. A young man in a white coat presided over this. "That's not much help," Hochstetter said. He was still smiling paternally, but he was mad. You didn't have to be a mind reader to know that. You had only to look in his eyes. "You don't listen," she said shrilly. "None of you listen except..." "Except John, but you can't say that." "Tell us how to fix it," Hochstetter said. She would not be placated. "If you listened, you'd know. That steel tray with the little pieces of wood, that's all right. But that's the only thing that is. The table's wood. That wall stuff, that's flammable. And so's that guy's clothes." She pointed to the technician, who flinched a little. "Charlie, that camera is too." "Charlie, that camera's... it's plastic. And if it gets hot enough, it will explode and little pieces will go everywhere. And there's no water. I told you, I have to push it at water once it gets started. My father and my mother told me so. I have to push it at water to put it out. Or... She burst into tears. She wanted John. She wanted her father. More than anything, oh, more than anything, she didn't want to be here. She had not slept at all last night. For his part, Hochstetter looked at her thoughtfully. The tears, the emotional upset. He thought those things made it as clear as anything that she was really prepared to go through with it. "All right," he said. "All right, Charlie. You tell us what to do, and we'll do it." "You're right," she said. "Or you don't get nothing." Hochstetter thought, "We'll get plenty, you snotty little bitch." As it turned out, he was absolutely right. 10. Late that afternoon, they brought her into a different room. She had fallen asleep in front of the TV when they brought her back to her apartment. Her body was still young enough to enforce its need on her worried, confused mind, and she'd slept for nearly 6 hours. As a result of that, and a hamburger and fries for lunch, she felt much better, more in control of herself. She looked carefully at the room for a long time. The tray of wood chips was on a metal table, The walls were gray industrial sheet steel, unadorned. Hochstetter said, "The technician there is wearing an asbestos uniform and asbestos slippers." He spoke down to her, still smiling his paternal smile. The EEG operator looked hot and uncomfortable. He was wearing a white cloth mask to avoid aspirating any asbestos fiber. Hochstetter pointed to a long square pane of mirror glass set into the far wall. "That's one-way glass. Our camera is behind it. And you see the tub." Charlie went over to it. It was an old-fashioned clawfoot tub, and it looked decidedly out of place in these stark surroundings. It was full of water. She thought it would do. "All right," she said. Hochstetter's smile widened. "Fine. Only you go in the other room there. I don't want to have to look at you while I do it." Charlie stared at Hochstetter inscrutably. "Something might happen." Hochstetter's paternal smile faltered a little. 11. "She was right, you know," Rainbird said. "If you'd listened to her, you could have got it right the first time." Hochstetter looked at him and grunted. "But you still don't believe it, do you?" Hochstetter, Rainbird, and Cap were standing in front of the one-way glass. Behind them, the camera peered into the room, and the Sony VCR hummed almost inaudibly. The glass was lightly polarized, making everything in the testing room look faintly blue, like scenery seen through the window of a Greyhound bus. The technician was hooking Charlie up to the EEG. A TV monitor in the observation room reproduced her brainwaves. "Look at those alphas," one of the technicians murmured. "She's really jacked up." "Scared," Rainbird said. "She's really scared." "You believe it, don't you?" Cap asked suddenly. "You didn't at first, but now you do." "Yes," Rainbird said. "I believe it." In the other room, the technician stepped away from Charlie. "Ready in here." Hochstetter flipped a toggle switch. "Go ahead, Charlie. When you're ready." Charlie glanced toward the one-way glass, and for an eerie moment she seemed to be looking right into Rainbird's one eye. He looked back, smiling faintly. 12. Charlie McGee looked at the one-way glass and saw nothing save her own reflection. But the sense of eyes watching her was very strong. She wished John could be back there. That would have made her feel more at ease. But she had no feeling that he was. She looked back at the tray of wood chips. It wasn't a push. It was a shove. She thought about doing it, and was again disgusted and frightened to find herself wanting to do it. She thought about doing it the way a hot and hungry person might sit in front of a chocolate ice cream soda and think about gobbling and slurping it down. And that was okay. But first you wanted just a moment to savor it. That wanting made her feel ashamed of herself, and then she shook her head almost angrily. "Why shouldn't I want to do it? If people are good at things, they always want to do them. Like Mommy with her double cross sticks, and Mr. DeRay down the street in Port City, always making bread. When they had enough at his house, he'd make some for other people. If you're good at something, you want to do it." Wood chips, she thought a little contemptuously. "They should have given me something hard." 13. The technician felt it first. He was hot and uncomfortable and sweaty in the asbestos clothing, and at first he thought that was all it was. Then he saw that the kid's alpha waves had taken on the high spike rhythm that is the hallmark of extreme concentration, and also the brain's signature of imagination. The sense of heat grew, and suddenly he was scared. 14. "Something happening in there," one of the technicians in the observation room said in a high, excited voice. "Temperature just jumped 10 degrees. Her alpha pattern looks like the fucking Andes." "There it goes," Cap exclaimed. "There it goes." His voice vibrated with the shrill triumph of a man who has waited years for the one moment now at hand. 15. She shoved as hard as she could at the tray of wood chips. They did not so much burst into flames as explode. A moment later, the tray itself flipped over twice, spraying chunks of burning wood, and clanged off the wall hard enough to leave a dimple in the sheet steel. the technician who had been monitoring at the EEG cried out in fear and made a sudden crazy dash for the door. The sound of his cry hurled Charlie suddenly back in time to the Albany airport. It was the cry of Eddie Delgado, running for the ladies' bathroom with his army-issue shoes in flames. She thought in sudden terror and exultation, "Oh, God, it's gotten so much stronger!" The steel wall had developed a strange dark ripple. The room had become explosively hot. In the other room, the digital thermometer, which had gone from 70 degrees to 80 and then paused, now climbed rapidly past 90 to 94 before slowing down. Charlie threw the fire thing at the tub. She was nearly panicked now. The water swirled, then broke into a fury of bubbles. In a space of 5 seconds, the contents of the tub went from cool to a rolling, steaming boil. The technician had exited, leaving the testing room door heedlessly ajar. In the observation room, there was a sudden, startled turmoil. Hockstetter was bellowing. Cap was standing gape-jawed at the window, watching the tub full of water boil. Clouds of steam rose from it, and the one-way glass began to fog over. Only Rainbird was calm, smiling slightly, hands clasped behind his back. He looked like a teacher whose star pupil has used difficult postulates to solve a particularly aggravating problem. "Back off!" screaming in her mind. "Back off! Back off! Back off!" And suddenly it was gone. Something disengaged, spun free for a second or two, and then simply stopped. Her concentration broke up and let the fire go. She could see the room again and feel the heat she had created bringing sweat to her skin. In the observation room, the thermometer crested at 96 and then dropped a degree. The wildly bubbling cauldron began to simmer down, but at least half of its contents had boiled away. In spite of the open door, the little room was as hot and moist as a steam room. 16. Hockstetter was checking his instruments feverishly. His hair, usually combed back so neatly and tightly that it almost seemed to scream, had now come awry, sticking up in the back. He looked a bit like Alfalfa of the Little Rascals. "Got it," he panted. "Got it. We got it all. It's on tape. The temperature gradient. Did you see the water in that tub boil? Jesus! Did we get the audio? We did? My God, did you see what she did?" He passed one of his technicians, whirled back, and grabbed him roughly by the front of his smock. "Would you say there was any doubt that she made that happen?" he shouted. The technician, nearly as excited as Hockstetter, shook his head. "No doubt at all, Chief. None." "Holy God," Hockstetter said, whirling away, distracted again. "I would have thought... something. Yes, something. But that tray flew." He caught sight of Rainbird, who was still standing at the one-way glass with his hands crossed behind his back, that mild, bemused smile on his face. For Hockstetter, old animosities were forgotten. He rushed over to the big Indian, grabbed his hand, pumped it. "We got it," he told Rainbird with savage satisfaction. "We got it all. It would be good enough to stand up in court. Right up in the fucking Supreme Court." "Yes, you got it," Rainbird agreed mildly. "Now you better send somebody along to get her." "Huh?" Hockstetter looked at him blankly. "Well," Rainbird said, still in his mildest tone, "the guy that was in there maybe had an appointment he forgot about, because he left in one hell of an ass-busting rush. He left the door open. And your fire starter just walked out." Hockstetter gaped at the glass. The steaming effect had got worse, but there was no doubt that the room was empty except for the tub, the EEG, the overturned steel tray, and the flaming scatter of wood chips. "One of you men go get her," Hockstetter cried, turning around. The 5 or 6 men stood by the instruments and didn't move. Apparently no one but Rainbird had noticed that Cap had left as soon as the girl had. Rainbird grinned at Hockstetter, and then raised his eye to include the others, these men whose faces had suddenly gone almost as pale as their lab smocks. "Sure," he said softly. "Which of you wants to go get the little girl?" No one moved. It was amusing, really. It occurred to Rainbird that this was the way the politicians were going to look when they found out it was finally done. That the missiles were really in the air, the bombs raining down, the woods and cities on fire. It was so amusing, he had to laugh, and laugh, and laugh. 17. "They're so beautiful," Charlie said softly.